Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hours Editorial Review. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hours Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Editorial Review and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events in the light of Bible prophecy, biblical law, and scriptural history. So stay tuned for tonight's special reports right after this message. Well, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, and then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, berries from Guatemala. Our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 population reduction program. Now, this globalization may be good for business, but globalization is bad for you and it's bad for me. Now, back in 1940, I can remember we all had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more. Today, we Americans have a three-day food supply in our refrigerators, and we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us. So over the past 60 years, we Americans have traded a one-year supply of food for 3 days. Now, do you think that's very wise? Now, these global 2,000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years. So says the Club of Rome, and HIV proves it. And these evil madmen with their global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause, but let you and I live for ours. And let me show you from the scriptures how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. Now, to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, I also have a subsistence and survival school that is available on compact disc for adult home study. That's not free. And if you're online, you can go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for the free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, you've heard me talk from time to time about RFID. RFID is radio frequency identification. There's a new wrinkle. Listen to this. CrossID, an Israeli startup founded by two engineers formerly at the telecommunications equipment provider RAD Group, has developed an innovative chipless RFID system that can protect sensitive documents such as intelligence agency reports, financial securities, and banknotes. You know what a banknote is? That's that $20 bill you carry in your pocket with that strip in it. The technology could also be used to create a hands-free barcode. The system uses nanometric materials, that is, tiny particles of chemicals with varying degrees of magnetism. They resonate when bombarded with electromagnetic waves from a reader, and each chemical emits its own distinct radio frequency or note that is picked up by the reader, and all of the notes emitted by a specific mix of different chemicals are then interpreted as a binary number. And since the system uses 70 different chemicals, each chemical is assigned its own position in a 70-digit binary number. For example, if the chemicals A, B, C, and D were assigned to the first, second, third, and fourth positions in the 70-digit number, then a mixture consisting of A and C would represent the binary number 1010, followed by 66 zeros. Cross-ID is testing readers that operate on 3 to 10 gigahertz, which is higher than the frequencies commonly used by wireless LANs and handheld computers, although the company has not made a final determination on what frequency the readers will use. These tiny chemical particles can be embedded in or printed on paper. Readers can be placed inside copy machines to prevent unauthorized copying. One application would be to require that any document printed on Cross-ID's special paper be photocopied onto the same type of paper. That way, an intelligence agency, financial institution, or even a company wanting to protect its intellectual property could install readers at building exits to prevent unauthorized people from copying documents and then leaving the building with them. Ah. Well, I can't blame somebody for wanting to protect their property and using that kind of technology to prevent theft. That's reasonable. So if Barnes & Noble were to put that on a label and stick it on their book so that when you check out, they take the label off, and if they don't take the label off or they don't remove it in some way, when you walk through the door, somebody is there, and they read it, and they say, wait a minute, you haven't paid for that book. Now, that's very reasonable, but let's try this. I had a student here one time. He'd saved $150,000. He had it in a safe deposit box down in Gasville, Arkansas. He went down, made a withdrawal, put it in a brown paper bag. The next day, the police came out, raided him, took his $150,000. How did they know he had it? Well, there's two ways. Number one, the bank has a key to all the safe deposit boxes, so they're not private. But number two, they probably had a scanner like this. You see, all of these bills now have this strip, and I've suspected for a long time that that strip is used to identify money. I've seen a number of cases where the highway patrol has stopped a car that had money in the trunk. Now, either one of two things. They're either scanning with some kind of a high-technology scanner every car that goes by and picks out the one that's carrying $1 million in the trunk, or two, they've got this scanner and they've identified those bills in some other way, like from a satellite or some other methodology, and they know what car to stop. Those strips in the money, I think, are RFID, radio frequency identifiers. And here's a company here now that has, for the first time to my knowledge, come out and said, yeah, we've got a technology that will do that. Well, who says that we didn't have this technology in the military application 10, 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Remember that SR-71 Blackbird, you know, that's a 1960s model airplane. That's pretty advanced technology, don't you think, at 2,000 miles an hour from 1968? Let's take a look here at oil, peak oil. I did a program not too long ago on peak oil. If you want to hear that program, put it with this one here, go to the archives and look for peak oil. Well, that's the way David Goodstein begins his book, and that's the way he ends it. Civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century unless we can find a way to live without fossil fuels. Well, Goodstein is not an environmental extremist or a doomsayer or a political hack trying to make points with his constituency. He's a professor of physics, and he's the vice provost of the California Institute of Technology, one of the nation's headiest institutions. In his just-released book, Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil, published by W.W. Norton & Company, Goodstein argues forcefully that the worldwide production of oil will peak soon, possibly within this decade, and that will be followed by declining availability of fossil fuels that could plunge the world into global conflicts as nations struggle to capture their piece of a shrinking pie. Now, we've all heard that before. only to be told by organizations like the United States Department of Energy that there's plenty of oil around. Much of it's still undiscovered, and there's no cause for panic. Some economists argue that as the supply declines, the price will rise, making it possible to develop energy sources that are not now available, such as the mineral-rich oil sands of Canada or the shale formations in the western United States. Now, here are some clues from a historical rebel. Sometime soon, we will find out who's right, but Goldstein argues that we don't have any time to spare, and it takes decades to develop new energy sources. As the prestigious National Academy of Sciences warned last week in a report on the dream of using hydrogen to fuel our cars. So are we poised to meet this challenge head on? Not very likely, Goldstein tells us. Nothing is going to happen until we have a crisis. It never does, it never has, and it won't now. Now, when we have a crisis, I think attitudes will then change. That crisis, he predicts, will probably come sooner rather than later. Now, how can experts from economics and science and business differ so strongly on an issue that is this important? And how can they look at the same data and then come to such different conclusions? Most predictions concerning the end of the age of oil are based on estimates of when the supply will run out and the last drop is pulled from the last well. But that's the wrong way to look at it, Goodstein argues. Goodstein relies partly on the work of a historical rebel in the oil industry, M. King Hubert. Hubert, back in the 1950s, was working as a geophysicist with the Shell Oil Company, and he predicted that oil production in the United States would peak by 1970. He was almost laughed out of his profession, but guess what? He turned out to be right. U.S. oil production has been declining ever since, leading to an increased reliance on foreign oil, and we all know where that has led us. Hubert's formula was really pretty simple. He looked at all of the geological reports that were available at that time, and he determined how much oil nature had created for us beneath the United States. Then he determined how much had been extracted. He found that half of it would be gone by 1970, and U.S. production would decline forever thereafter. Now, here are the best and the worst case scenarios. Globally, nature left about 2 trillion barrels underneath the ground, and the peak will occur when we reach the halfway point. You're listening to the Law Hours Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. All of these editorial review programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion. Jesus of Nazareth held that same view when he said in Matthew 24, verse 22, that except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. Now, there are 64 life-threatening problems described in the Scripture detailing this New World Order and their Global 2000 genocide agenda. And the Scripture teaches preparation for this great tribulation, not apathy and or indifference. Now, it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. You know, politicians like Ted Kennedy and Arlen Specter and Hillary or that guy John in the Justice Department. And I say let's prepare to live through and survive this global 2000 New World Order nightmare. Now, to do just that, why don't you call, write, or email the law school and ask for those 64 life-threatening problems. They're free. You get those from the scriptures, and I'll show you where they're at. Let's talk about formulating a real, meaningful, intelligent plan to survive Global 2000 and these other 64 life-threatening problems that are called the Great Tribulation in Scripture. You can call and order my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Remember, my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Peak oil. I did a program on peak oil and gave more information. In fact, I think I did it for several days. If you'll go to the archive, you can take a look at peak oil. It's upon us already, and this guy is giving us the best and the worst-case scenarios as to how this is going to play out. Globally, nature left us about 2 trillion barrels of oil into the ground. And that peak is going to occur when we reach the halfway point. Goodstein argues that since we have used close to 1 trillion barrels, the peak can't be more than a few years away, he says. But are huge new oil fields waiting out there somewhere to be discovered? Well, better to believe in the tooth fairy, he writes. Most of the planet has been explored extensively, and even if some new fields are found, they will not delay the peak by more than a few years, he says. So that leads him to 2 scenarios. In the worst-case scenario, after Hubert's peak, all efforts to produce, distribute, and consume alternative fuels fast enough to fill the gap between falling supplies and rising demand fail. Runaway inflation and worldwide depression leave many billions of people with no alternative but to burn coal in vast quantities for warmth, cooking, and primitive industry. Now, this change in the greenhouse effect that results eventually tips Earth's climate into a new state hostile to life. And then we reach the end of the story. In the best case scenario, the worldwide disruptions that follow Hubert's peak serve as a global wake-up call. A methane-based economy is successful in bridging the gap temporarily while nuclear power plants are built and the infrastructure for other alternative fuels is put in place. Then the world watches anxiously as each new Hubert's peak estimate for uranium and oil shale makes front page news. A number of things can be done, but all have some limitations, and all take the one thing that we're running out of, and that's time. And there can't be a quick resolution, Goldstein said in the interview. It's a huge problem. Is it time to switch? Well, he would begin an immediate shift toward a greater reliance on natural gas, since supplies of methane are greater than the remaining oil. And he sees no alternative to building more nuclear power plants. Now, that's not going to sit well with many of the anti-nuke Americans, but there are difficulties and dangers associated with nuclear power. But there may be no other alternative, he writes. Other potential sources of energy, like oil shale, are fraught with environmental problems, and they may take more energy to develop than they will ultimately produce. Now, that's been the case in other fields, including fusion reactors that could make their own fuel. Despite the fact that the federal government has poured billions into fusion research, no experimental reactor has ever produced more energy than it consumes, not even for a second. Ultimately, Goldstein argues, we must return to the energy source used by our ancestors thousands of years ago. There's a cheap, plentiful supply of energy available for the taking, he says, and we will not run out of it for billions of years, and that's called sunlight. Therein lies the greatest hope. New technological breakthroughs could finally harness the sun in ways that we haven't even begun to imagine. But it's going to take a commitment on a global scale that would make the Manhattan Project seem puny by comparison. And here we are in the midst of a presidential election campaign, and no one's even talking about it. Well, that peak oil story is a little bit of a political problem or a political deal that's coming up. I've said before, we've got about 4 trillion barrels of oil here in the United States in shale oil. We used to produce shale oil in this country, and it costs about $30 a barrel to produce. Oil is now selling up toward $40 a barrel. It hasn't quite got there yet, but it's up in that neck of the woods. And we could certainly produce oil at $30 a barrel here and put millions of Americans to work in the process and quit buying this foreign oil, leave that for somebody else, and put up trade barriers so that they can't undersell us and live our lives happily ever after. Well, for at least 600 years, because that's about how much oil and coal we have in the United States, another 600-year supply at the rate that we use it, at the rate of about 6 billion barrels a year. Now, our peak oil came and it went with underground supplies. There's no doubt about that. And what we're facing is peak oil, a political-induced peak oil problem. And that's why we're in Iraq. It's to help us stave off that peak oil because that country, Iraq, has 25% of the world's oil supply. So the fight in Iraq, you know, while we're telling Americans the fight in Iraq is because we're good guys and we're trying to topple a dictator. Boys and girls, if we wanted to topple a dictator, Kim Il-sung over in North Korea would be a better guy to topple. And the reason we're not over there toppling the North Korean government is because there's no oil in North Korea. That means there's no money there. Just follow the money. That's why we're in Iraq. That's why we control Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf Emirates. Well, the HIV rate in New York City, especially in men, is a lot higher than thought. Close to 4% of men between the ages of 40 and 49 living in New York City are infected with HIV. Researchers from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, reported this statistic is quite overwhelming, as is the finding that 2.8% of all men living in Manhattan have HIV infection or AIDS. Also, even though we think we're doing well with prevention of serious complications by using antiretroviral therapy, he added. The death rates among HIV-infected persons in New York are still 4 times higher than the age and gender-matched population, so we've still got a long way to go. Although data have been available for the number of full-blown AIDS cases, the reporting of HIV infections by New York City health care providers was only implemented in June of 2000, Jaffe explained. Now, the lead investigator, Dennis Nash of the New York City Department of Health, and colleagues reported the results of data collected on HIV infection as of December 31, 2001. During this period, there were 6,478 new HIV diagnosed cases in New York City. That's about 81 cases for every 100,000 people. Nash told conference participants 65% of the cases were in men and 35% in women. HIV infection rates were 5 times higher among non-Hispanic blacks, 2.5 times higher among Hispanics compared with non-Hispanic whites. Now, pay attention to that. This HIV is 5 times higher in blacks, and 2.5 times higher among Hispanics than it is in whites. These findings provide a more accurate picture of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in New York City, and it may also help redirect prevention efforts to high-risk groups, the investigators added. This AIDS thing is totally out of control in Africa, and it's threatening to go ballistic in India. If they can't control it in India, then there's going to be a tremendous worldwide AIDS pandemic. The Chinese have it slowed. The Indians don't. We've got it slowed here in the United States, but it costs about $100,000 to die now from AIDS, about the same price that it now costs to die from cancer. Let's take a look at intellectuals here for a minute. It might be illusion or it might just be reality that the entire Bush presidency and everything for which it stands is in a state of slow collapse. It's slowly dawning on people that the whole rationale for the billions spent, the tens of thousands dead, and all the hysteria was a hoax. Of course, the same could be said of most all wars. Why is the truth making a difference this time, then? Well, because ideas have been denationalized, and the world population, for the first time in 50 years, with independent intellectuals. Now, listen to this. After World War II, academia went through a dramatic change for the worse. It was simultaneously democratized and given the primary mission of serving the state. The GI Bill, a vast expansion of ill-gotten gains pumped into academia, did the democratizing work, not because the political elite thought everyone should get a degree, but because they feared mass unemployment and had too little confidence in the market to absorb returning soldiers. The change in the mission of academia was nothing more than a continuation of wartime culture over which the state was completely dominant. Not only academia changed, the years between 1944 and 1949, the Marshall Plan, GI Bill, the Cold War, fiscal and monetary planning, cultural and economic regimentation set the stage for the next half century. The state secured many, though not all, of its gains made during wartime, and the effects rippled throughout America and American society. To be professionally ambitious meant to keep a constant eye on the centralized edifice to see what its priorities were. It was clear to all that the state was the prime mover, the first cause of all important events in America. And we know what it is like in our time to suffer under a state that uses events as a form of political intimidation to shut down critics. Object to the police state in our time and you confront teeming hordes of bureaucrats and state apologists screaming 9/11 at you. Now back then it was worse. The terrifying power of the state throughout the war, drafting, taxing, planning, censoring, and then, of course, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the instant torching of mass civilian populations, was the psychological lever by which the state effectively nationalized the culture far more completely and far more effectively than it can now. Intellectuals then were owned, whether in academia or journalism. Everyone who aspired to think and exercise intellectual influence knew the right course of action. The state was where the action was. In journalism, the answer was to attend the right schools where you learned the ropes and went to work for a major network or print outlet like the New York Times or CBS. And very few could be described as independent. Political scientists had one charge, make the state run more efficiently. The same was true of economists. To be a success meant to work your way up to the president's Council of Economic Advisers. It was a science of planning, and Keynes was its muse. In the same way that a socialized economy cannot put new technology into effect and thus yields no civilizational advance, the world of ideas was frozen into a pattern that was fixed and unchanging. There were official texts, official journals, official schools from which all lower schools took their marching orders, and public schools became extensions of this overarching top-down system of idea enforcement. Christian churches put U.S. flags in their sanctuaries. Baseball players sing the national anthem. American families had the president's picture on the wall. The children's TV shows and everyone watching. Back for the closer. You're listening to the Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Your support of Truth Radio and of our advertisers and sponsors is important to us, so for more information about Truth Radio Network, and go to our webpage. It's truthradio.org. That's truthradio.org. And Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution. Donations are not tax-deductible. If they were tax-deductible, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. That's counterproductive. So we rely instead upon the financial support of our listening audience. That helps us. It doesn't pay for everything, but it does help us pay for our satellite time, internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs. And we encourage you to help us with this task. And we want to thank you very much for that financial support. It comes through your donations that you make here to Truth Radio. P.O. Box 344 Napomo in IPOMO, California 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio. Post Office Box 344, Napomo, NIPOMO, California 93444. Here's tonight's wise old saying. If you try to please everybody, nobody will like it. All right, the new intellectuals. Continuing. If you're trained to be uncritical of the military, you can easily go a little further and learn to be uncritical of government and authority, writes Paul Fusel, and even to be uncritical of all established and received institutions. The ultimate result is the death of the mind, the transformation of the higher learning and the independent scholarship into a cheering section for whatever popular notions and superstitions prevail at the moment, such as evolution. What is clear about the culture of war is that it is necessarily an obedience culture. And the obedience culture is certain over the long run to shrivel originality and to constrict thought, to encourage witless adaptation and social dishonesty. Were there no dissidents? Well, there were a few, but recall that the old right intellectual movement had pretty well been killed off by the war in Pearl Harbor. FDR's unrelenting campaign against his critics, combined with the massive power of the presidency and the press, had an inevitable effect. Critics were dead or silent. The Taft forces in the House and Senate had their moments in beating back some legislation, but it wasn't long until they too met the fate of all opponents of the establishment in those days. They were smeared and crushed by the onrushing Cold War Leviathan. A few institutes and institutions worked to break through, but it took massive efforts, and those who dared poke their head out of the trenches were fired on mercilessly. Leonard Reed of the Foundation for Economic Education was hauled before a congressional hearing to account for his anti-war stance. The John Birch Society was smeared as a hate group. The American right wing was reconstituted as nothing but an intellectual arm of the warfare state, publishing a fortnightly that counseled expanding the U.S. military empire, suppressing civil liberties, working within the system, and retreating on almost every other front. Only by looking back at this tableau of 50 years ago does the striking, remarkable reality of today come through. If you just take a look at the free market right in this country and the sheer number of publications, conferences, academic journals, and scholars, it's a picture of exuberance and productivity unknown in the 20th century. It is very likely today that you will find the same intellectuals writing for academic journals as well as blogging on their favorite website or writing for newspapers, something unheard of in the old days. This new academic class of 30-somethings does not feel itself kept in any sense. They obey the social controls of the new PC university, but otherwise they think and say what they please. The best journals today are not published by universities or large publishing houses, but rather they're published by nonprofits such as the Mrs. Institute, or the Independent Institute, the Action Institute, and many, many others like them. These are journals that seek to make a difference in the world. They aren't just manuals for state planning, as academic journals used to be. In books, no one takes marching orders from nationally approved lists as people did in the generations past. As for news sources, you know the story. The cartel has been entirely smashed. The promises of libertarian ideas in the debate today is notable. But what is most striking is the presence of debate at all. And the left does great good in exposing the nefarious plans of the Republicans and drumming up anti-war sentiment. Something resembling a free market in ideas is present today in a way in which it was not in the late 1940s and the 1950s. The debate, the conversation, is not national but global now, and it goes on constantly in forums so numerous that it's impossible to keep up with them all. The spread and speed of ideas makes it impossible for the state to manage opinion with anywhere near the degree of control that it once had in the 1940s and 50s. The time was when a president on a major network spoke ex cathedra. Now he is subject to relentless criticism and even ridicule minutes after he finishes his speech. The Bush administration has never understood the changed political and cultural environment which it has inherited when it took office. It operated on the old assumption that controlling the state and its major adjunct industries was enough to carry the day. To supercharge an economy and win a war was simply a matter of will and money. The lies were seen as incidental, inevitable, and wholly justifiable part of stagecraft in politics. But now we live in times that devour anyone who aspires to be the one all-controlling national or international will. Real intellectuals, and they're everywhere today, will never stand for it. Now, what has made the difference? Technology? Sure, may be the day of the monolithic nation state managed from the top down has just run its course. Or maybe the work of those who dared dissent from approved opinion in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s is finally coming to fruition. Mises, Hayek, Rothbard, and all the other courageous people who never bought the line back then gave a great gift to the world, which we are now just unwrapping. The new intellectuals. Well, let's see here. I've heard a few of your radio broadcasts a couple of years ago and recently tried to find you again, and so I have at long last. I wondered if you know of any way to get around having a Social Security number to file taxes. My husband has a Social Security number and has always just filed as single, but this year he needed to claim me as his spouse in order not to pay a large sum to the IRS. And I find that they won't let me file because I don't have a Social Security number. So do you have any thoughts or wisdom that you could share with us? I would be grateful. Hey, listen, that's pretty important. Did you hear what that lady just said? The IRS will not let this lady file without a Social Security number. My goodness. The secret's out. Your Social Security number is your taxpayer identification number. Has been since 1964. It's the connecting link with the income tax. Did it ever occur to you that if you'd get rid of your Social Security number, stop practicing income and practice property, you wouldn't have any income tax, you wouldn't have any income, you wouldn't have any filings to make? Now, if you want to file, what you need is a federal tax ID number. So only people with Social Security numbers or federal tax identification numbers can file. You have to be a taxpayer. You have to be a member of the club. That's why I don't want to be a member of the club. That's why I don't have a Social Security number. That's why I don't collect Social Security. I don't want to pay. I don't want to collect. I don't want to participate. Now, your husband should reserve his Social Security number and stop producing or, excuse me, let me back up. Your husband should rescind his Social Security number and stop producing income. Produce property, not profit. If you have income, then you must pay the income tax. Property is not taxed in this country. Go to Diefendorf versus Goulet. I've mentioned that on many programs when we talk about taxes. But in this case, ma'am, if you want to file your tax return, then you're going to need a taxpayer identification number. You don't have a Social Security number. All right, what else is going on here? Gosh, we only got a minute left. I got a story here that we can do in a minute. Here's a quickie. More than 160 illegal immigrants, some who had not eaten in days, were found crammed inside of a house in a well-to-do Phoenix suburb, officials said. Several men believed to be immigrant smugglers were arrested during Wednesday's roundup. The immigrants from Mexico and Central America were sitting shoulder to shoulder, back to back, said Russell L.R. He's a spokesman for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You could not see the carpet. Federal and state authorities found the immigrants in a house along a golf course. Some had paid their smugglers up to $6,000, R. said. Hey, these people are spending $6,000 to get smuggled into the United States. You know, that's good business. My goodness. No wonder there's 2,000 people a day coming into the United States. This is big business. I'll bet that's bigger than dope. Now, about 60 of the men, women, and juveniles were discovered locked in bathrooms with deadbolts, leading investigators to think that they might have been hostages. And then, of course, there was an assault rifle and a handgun that were also found. I don't know what relevance a handgun and an assault rifle have. They found 160 of these illegal aliens. That's the story. I mean, they might as well have reported that they found some cocaine and marijuana with them also. They more than likely had some. What difference does that make to the story? Well, none of the bathrooms was working in the house, nor was there any furniture or food except for some canned goods, authorities said. Then after the roundup, the immigrants were fed and checked against federal databases for criminal and immigration history. Oz said those without prior infractions would be sent back home. Well, that's a tragedy. It'll cost them another $6,000 to get back a second time, and it'll cost them $12,000 to finally succeed. You can bet they're going to be back. I mean, after all, they're promising them. The Democrats just started today, and they said, hey, listen, we got a plan. Let's give these 12 million illegal aliens. We did that back in the 90s. Remember, we went 5 million then. Now we got 12. Let's give 12 million aliens. And then we can get 24 million. All right. We're out of time. We're out of time. Same station. Thanks for listening. Until then.